On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When President Bush doesn't like a law passed by the Congress of the United States, he doesn't veto it. He just states that he won't follow it. Except for one time this week in his veto of stem cell research, this president's preferred path is the so-called signing statement. He takes a law and essentially picks and chooses what he will enforce and obey. And not just a little. In 6 years in office, George W. Bush has challenged some 800 newly minted laws, more than all previous presidents in American history combined. He wasn't the first to do it. The White House says he has good reason. A new report from the American Bar Association says this is unconstitutional, against the rule of law, and the edge of a crisis. Up next on Point, the president of the ABA on presidential power and the Bush White House. In a moment, we will speak with Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association, about the newly released ABA report raising the alarm on presidential signing statements. But first, for an update on the controversy, we go to Cheryl Gay Stolberg in Washington. She is White House correspondent for The New York Times. Cheryl, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How did all this suddenly become such a big deal? How did this come to public light?
Well, the signing statements actually burst into news earlier this year when the president signed the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005. That was a bill barring cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of detainees in American custody. Mr. Bush had objected to it and initially threatened to veto it, then backed down. But when he signed it, he issued a signing statement saying that he would reserve the right to interpret its provisions in accordance with what he saw as his constitutional authority as commander-in-chief. Senators objected at the time, and Mr. Bush continued to use such signing statements. And now, as you mentioned, we have an American Bar Association report issued Sunday saying that the president was flouting the Constitution and undermining the rule of law by issuing these signing statements.
Were these statements secret before they came to light with the detainee torture legislation, or just not talked about?
I think the latter. I wouldn't say they were secret, but I think they just were not talked about very much. Senator Patrick Leahy, the senior Democratic member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, says that he noticed a signing statement back in 2002 when the president signed a law to rein in corporate abuses, like the one that occurred at Enron. Back then, Mr. Leahy says he saw this technique as unorthodox, unwise, and unsound, but still they didn't attract very much attention until the Detainee Treatment Act of earlier this year.
Now the chairman of this ABA task force is saying that maybe 800 times the president has issued challenges to provisions of laws, and the thing that everyone's quoting is that this is more than all other presidents in American history combined. Is that charge standing up?
Well, the data that we have is data from the ABA, and I certainly have no reason to dispute it. Interestingly, much of the president's language is boilerplate or formulaic, according to the ABA. They say he often issued no citation of authority or detailed explanation, quote, for his signing statements. The ABA is urging Congress to pass a law requiring that the president set forth his reasons in full for any signing statements issued in the future.
Is Congress responding to that? Are there moves afoot to either ask the president to be more specific about his objections or to try and just rein in this habit overall?
Yes, there are. Senator Leahy's Republican counterpart, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, said this week that he would challenge the practice of signing statements and would introduce legislation giving Congress the right to bring a lawsuit against the statements. And I should add that Democrats, especially Democrats and some Republicans on Capitol Hill over the past year, have been concerned about the way Mr. Bush exercises his broad authority as the nation's chief executive. And so this taps into kind of a vein of sentiment that already existed on Capitol Hill, a frustration, if you will, with the White House.
But what about the Republican majority in Congress? Are they not concerned about this? Are they supporting the president, saying, do as you like?
Well, Mr. Specter certainly is a member of the Republican majority in Congress, although he often finds himself at odds with some of his fellow Republicans. I think we'll have to wait and see how this plays out on Capitol Hill. You know, even though Republicans do support the president, members of Congress feel very strongly that they have the right to draft and pass legislation, and this is within their purview. So they also feel kind of an institutional prerogative to protect their authority against what they view as an incursion by the president.
You cover the White House. This presidency has been very forthright about its push, particularly we're told in the office of the vice president, Dick Cheney, to reassert presidential power. Do you see or hear any sign that the Bush White House is preparing to sort of stand back on this, stand down, maybe change its ways?
Well, I think you see perhaps a small sign. We saw it, we're seeing it in the debate over legislation that is the fallout from the Supreme Court's ruling in the Hamdan v. Rumsfeld case. That was the Supreme Court case that found Mr. Bush's executive order creating commissions to try detainees did not pass muster. And the administration does seem to be working with members of Congress now. The White House essentially was slapped down by the Supreme Court on that. And they are reaching out to members of Congress to try to draft legislation that meets Congress's approval and would pass constitutional muster, according to the Supreme Court. But I think, by and large, this is still an administration that is interested in expanding executive authority and using it in a very muscular, aggressive way.
And we have seen that. Cheryl Gaze-Tolberg at the White House, thanks very much for joining us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Cheryl Gaze-Tolberg, White House correspondent for The New York Times. She spoke to us from Washington. Joining us now from Washington is Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association and a stern critic of the mounting use of presidential signing statements. He brought together the ABA task force that released a report this week warning of a constitutional crisis on the separation of powers in Washington. Michael Greco, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the program, Tom.
What is the crisis that you see brewing here?
Very simply, the Constitution of the United States assigns certain powers to three branches of government: the executive, the judiciary, and Congress. The founders of our country purposely separated that immense power that government has into three branches so that each of those branches could check and balance the power of the others. What's happening now is that presidential signing statements is being used as a tool to circumvent that separation of powers doctrine. Whenever you have a president, and we're not singling out President Bush, presidents since Reagan, last 25 years, have used presidential signing statements increasingly. But it is this president who, as you said at the top, has done it more than 800 times. He has challenged more than 800 provisions of law, more than every other president combined before him. When you take power from Congress and give it to the executive branch, you've just upset the system of checks and balances. Congress is no longer able to check the power of the president to declare what laws he will enforce. And this is why the task force found that this is contrary to the Constitution and violates the Constitution. Let me make one thing clear. The president under the Constitution has two choices when Congress has enacted a bill, and the two choices couldn't be clearer. Either approve the bill, sign it in toto, everything. You cannot cherry pick. Or if you're troubled by it, veto it and then send it back to Congress. A presidential signing statement is neither of those options, and it's not sanctioned by the Constitution. And in fact, this is what is causing Congress to lose its voice in the government, because when a veto happens, that veto has to go back to Congress so that Congress can look at the concerns of the president, can modify that legislation, change it, reissue it, reenact it, or, most powerfully, Congress can override the veto by a two-thirds majority vote. Right now, what the president is doing is to deny Congress that all-important role of overriding the president. The president now, under these signing statements, is both Congress, having the last word on whether something is a law, president deciding what he will enforce, and also the judiciary, because when he says something is unconstitutional, he's taking the role of the judiciary. So we have then a situation that the founders clearly wanted to avoid. the amassing of power into one branch. They separated it. We've got to keep them separate.
The report says the Constitution is not what the president says it is. It also says it warns of an evolution here on the president's part into a monarch-like absolute veto. That's a pretty big fear and charge. What is at stake here, Michael Greco?
Well, let me go back into history a little bit. When the founders wrote the Constitution, fresh in their minds were the experiences in England. King James II did something similar to what the president is now doing. That king took unto himself the power to ignore acts of Parliament. He disregarded them. He said, I'm not going to enforce these. When the founders wrote the Constitution, they had that example in mind, and so they put in the Constitution that the executive must enforce the laws. So the founders put that obligation on the president to enforce the laws.
We're talking this hour with the president of the American Bar Association, Michael Greco, about George W. Bush's signing statements and the Bush White House push for executive authority. A new ABA task force report says President Bush is ignoring law, flouting the Constitution, and courting a crisis. Joining me right now from Washington, from the Department of Justice, is Michelle Boardman. She is Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Counsel at the DOJ, former Assistant Professor of Law at George Mason Law School. Michelle Boardman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
The new report from the ABA says that the president's use of signing statements is against the rule of law and the Constitution. What do you say?
I was surprised by that finding, I have to admit. Every president since Eisenhower and plenty before have issued signing statements in which that president has stated he would refuse to execute unconstitutional provisions. This is a position that's been consistent across White Houses, regardless of party. This was the position of President Carter and President Clinton's White Houses. And let me just say, so we have a concrete vision of what the report suggests. The report's conclusion is that a president must enforce an unconstitutional law until the Supreme Court tells him he can stop. That means he doesn't have his independent duty to defend and uphold the Constitution that the Constitution gives to the president.
If the president thinks a law is problematic, why not just veto it? If he can pick and choose what he'll enforce and obey, where's the balance of powers?
It's a good question. I think the veto suggestion is really a red herring because it doesn't solve the problem. And let me give you an example. The president, every president, has an obligation to enforce and defend the Constitution, and that's true as to laws that were passed before he took office. It's true as to laws that he signed that the Supreme Court later finds unconstitutional. And it's true as to laws that he vetoes but then has the veto overridden. So let's suppose Congress passes a bill that requires all Department of Justice attorneys to be men. That means the president has to fire me. First, the president vetoes the bill, but Congress overrides it so it becomes law. Now, under the task force approach, the president has to fire me and all other female attorneys until the Supreme Court holds the law unconstitutional.
Why not at least wait and see if there is a veto? I mean, in that case, if that's what you're arguing, why not wait? Because Congress might very well not override a veto.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that this president, like most presidents, often issues a signing statement that says, I think this law on its face is constitutional. I'm concerned down the road that there might be an unconstitutional application, and I just want to be upfront about that possibility. But why veto what is a constitutional law now, just because there may be a problem down the road?
Michelle Boardman, if the president can pick and choose what laws he's going to enforce and obey, I mean, you frame it as him doing it in defense of the Constitution. But if a president can pick and choose what he'll enforce, what he'll obey, what's the difference between a president and a king?
Well, there's a great deal of difference between a president and a king. The president actually has very little leeway on this front. He cannot pick and choose. The Constitution allows some things and forbids others. And if he issues a constitutional signing statement, he can only object to those provisions that are, in fact, either currently unconstitutional or might be unconstitutional down the road.
But it's been a pretty broad spectrum. I mean, he's challenged a ban on torturing detainees. He's challenged oversight provisions in the Patriot Act, restrictions on using U.S. troops against rebels in Colombia, requirements to provide information to Congress. I mean, it's a pretty broad spectrum.
It is a broad spectrum. The vast majority of the signing statements you just listed were actually statements where the president said, as I've said before, this law seems constitutional. I have every intention of enforcing it. But if in the end it comes to a point where I have to choose between my duty as commander-in-chief under the Constitution to safeguard national security information and complying with this law, then we may have a problem. President Clinton and other presidents issued very similar, some practically verbatim signing statements on the exact same issue, saying the president must protect national security information.
Michael Greco, here's the case from Michelle Boardman, the Department of Justice, Office of Legal Counsel, saying, hey, you know, you're upset about something that's quite reasonable. The president is simply trying himself to enforce and defend the Constitution.
Well, I disagree, and I think the numbers tell the different story. The fact that President Bush has issued one veto in his presidency, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 16 years issued 635 vetoes, we have a situation where one president, Roosevelt, was following the Constitution and what it requires of the president and Congress, and a president who is choosing to do something other than follow the Constitution with the veto.
In principle, what's the difference between 8 signing statements, let's say, and 800, George Bush's number? What's the difference in principle?
Well, the difference in principle is the use to which this president is making. And Michelle gave an extreme example, and even in that example was not entirely accurate. That is the hiring of all male attorneys. If that wacky bill ever was considered or anything like it by Congress, there is immediate recourse. You can seek an injunction as to the enforcement of that bill. There's no requirement on the president that he enforce that law. If he vetoes it and sends it back, we have an example just the other day, the stem cell research bill, which the president vetoed, first one in his presidency. Congress moved rapidly, so the idea that the veto is cumbersome, impractical, outdated, if all those things are true, then what we're saying is the Constitution of the United States is outdated and impractical and clumsy, and that just isn't the case.
Michelle Boardman, I asked Michael Greco what's the difference between 8 and 800, Bush's number. If you say 800 is okay, then what's the difference between 800 and 8,000? What is to prevent I don't think it's funny.
No, I don't think it's funny, and I do agree that if a president issued a great number more signing statements than his predecessors, it would definitely be a cause for inquiry and concern.
Which President Bush has.
He has not.
He has not?
Let me be clear about what's being counted in that 800 figure, and then so you don't have to take my word for it, I can back it up. The 800 figure, which is also the basis for the claim that the president has issued more signing statements than all others, is not counting signing statements. It's not counting the number of laws or statutes on which the president has commented. It's a count, accurate or not, of the precise provisions and sub-provisions within laws. So let me give you a concrete example.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Congress passes one bill, so that becomes one law, and the president issues one signing statement on it. In that statement, he objects to provisions 4A, 4B2, 4C, and 4D. It's all one objection, but it's 4 sub-provisions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you show that signing statement to anyone on the street, I don't care if they have a law degree or not, they're not going to say, oh, I see, the president has concerns about 4 laws. That person is rightly going to count one signing statement and one law. But that 800 number is counting provisions. What's more, that's being compared to prior presidents, and you can't do that because prior presidents were just less specific than this president. Prior presidents wrote these provisions, several provisions, whereas this president has been more upfront and more clear. I don't think he should be penalized.
Point by point, Michael Greco, what about, I'm reading here the New York Times editorial says, over 212 years, 42 presidents issued signing statements objecting to a grand total of 600 provisions of new laws. We've got the nuance there. George W. Bush has done that more than 800 times in just over 5.5 years in office. Is that an apples to apples, a fair comparison, or not, Michael Greco?
It's absolutely a fair comparison. What the report that the ABA task force issued clearly says that this president has complained about or decided not to enforce more than 800 provisions of law. And that's the comparison being made to every other president preceding him. I think what we're getting here is if I may, a little doublespeak. When we hear from Michelle Boardman that this president is upfront and candid and construing the Constitution validly, the fact is most of these signing statements, formulaic or not, aren't even being sent to Congress until our task force dug into it, we didn't know that there were 800. We didn't know what most of them said. And contrary to what Michelle just said, most of these statements clearly indicate an intention by the president not to enforce these provisions of law. That puts the president above a law that Congress has enacted. That act puts the president in a more powerful position by taking power away from Congress, because Congress right now cannot do anything with a presidential signing statement that it can do with a veto. Mm. Why isn't the president vetoing bills as all of his predecessors have done? The implication is that he likes it both ways. He can do a signing statement, announce that he's not going to enforce the law, and essentially handcuff Congress from doing anything about it. That's why one of our recommendations in the report is that Congress enact a law giving the president, as well as Congress and others, the right to seek judicial review of what the president is doing. And Senator Specter, yesterday afternoon on the floor of the Senate,
yes,
complimented the ABA task force's report, and indicated that the legislation that he is filing with Congress essentially, I think, from what I can tell, is tracking the fourth recommendation of our task force's report. Mm-hmm. And by the way, just so that people are reminded, the task force I appointed is a bipartisan task force. It has respected Republicans and conservatives on it. And that task force came out with a unanimous report and unanimous recommendations. So anyone who thinks that this is a challenge to this president, not true. It's a challenge to the practice of using these statements to circumvent the separation of powers doctrine and checks and balances. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so dangerous about what's going on.
Michelle Boardman, you're a lawyer. You're watching this closely. Do you not lose any sleep over this? Senator Specter, Republican, Pennsylvania, calls this a very blatant encroachment on the constitutional prerogatives of Congress to write laws. ABA, not exactly a fly-by-night organization, bipartisan, unanimous. Are you losing no sleep over this?
I am not losing sleep over it. This practice has a historical pedigree as long as the day, and the vast majority of prior presidents have engaged in this practice. If we want to talk about whether this is a partisan issue, again, I have to say the administrations of all modern presidents, including Presidents Carter and President Clinton, thought, first of all, that there was no need to veto a law because one small provision might raise a constitutional question. Secondly, that it was entirely appropriate to issue a signing statement refusing to execute a constitutional provision. But third, like this president, usually simply flagging a constitutional issue is a
But now you've got big-time Republican conservatives on this ABA panel waving their arms and saying, we've got a problem here. We're going to hear from one of them, Bruce Fein, from the Reagan administration later in this hour, but that is not of concern to you.
Well, sure. You know, reasonable minds can differ on this issue. It's always contentious between the legislative and executive branches. The separation of powers gave both of those branches certain powers, some of which overlap, and we expect them to fight back and forth. My disappointment with the task force report was that it seemed to be concerned only with the possibility of executive aggregation of power. It didn't seem concerned that the legislature might be passing laws as they are, as all legislatures have, that attempt to get into presidential powers, take them away and take them over for themselves. Separation of powers requires both branches, including also the third branch of the judiciary, to defend and uphold the Constitution and to attempt to protect the power of each branch.
So you say it's the Congress that's out of line here. I know we have to let you go, Michelle Boardman. We're glad that you joined us. Thank you very much for
Thank
your
you,
time.
Tom.
Michelle Boardman, Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. Robert is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I believe one reason why there's so little public outcry about these signing statements is that, at least from where I sit, there are just a lot of people out there that are really looking for one person, one authority figure that they want to call king or queen, but they want to feel that that one person is going to keep them safe, especially post 9/11. When 9/11 happened, George Bush's approval ratings skyrocketed. And I think that would have happened with any one person, just because people are looking for that one person. They don't want to get caught in, you know, this kind of inside baseball signing statement thing, but they want one person who they feel is going to keep them safe. And that's why there are so many people who are just willing to go along.
But, Robert, this isn't just any old country. This is the United States with a history-making constitution and democracy. You think Americans just give up those checks and balances just as easy as that? Kiss my hand?
Well, it seems to be happening. I mean, it seems to be, I don't talk to anyone who says that, you know, this is such a horrible thing. I mean, I believe that, you know.
You think that they want the strong guy up on top, and maybe that's what they're getting. Let's get another call. Robert, thank you very much for yours. Let me turn to Scituate, Massachusetts, and Joe. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Yes, this is a great topic. I'm a conservative Republican, voted for Bush both times, continued to support his foreign policy despite many of my neighbors here in Massachusetts. But the selective enforcement of the law is demonstrated by these letters. The executive's role under the Constitution is clear, to enforce the law as passed by the Congress. He can say veto or not veto, the ABA is exactly right, but by putting ambiguity into this required a role of enforcing the law with these letters, I think, is extra constitutional exercise of power. It makes any strict constitutionalist like myself afraid of our future. And I think, in fact, it's Bush trying to react to what he perceives, which I also perceive, is the exercise of extra constitutional legislative authority by the courts, which Bush is constantly saying, like in Massachusetts, as far as gay marriage, he clearly publicly objects to that and is trying.
So he's going to try a little of it of his own, maybe. But let's keep this in the constitutional house here. Joe, thanks very much for your call. Let me get one more before the break from Florence, South Carolina. Adam is on the line. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very
interesting,
well.
Interesting topic. My main point would be that I don't think George Bush is the sole person making these decisions to do it that way, and that there must be a select few people that are advising him to do it this way. So what does that really mean for the American people?
You mean it's not even the president? It's some power behind the throne, you're saying?
Exactly.
Let us pick it up, Adam. Our time is short before the break. Michael Greco, there has been a lot of talk about the office of the vice president being very big on the unitary executive authority view of presidential power. Do you see the thinking that's promoting this coming out of the vice president's office?
Well, we heard Michelle Boardman a moment ago try to make the case that it's Congress that's trying to aggregate power onto itself, and that it's the poor president who is trying to, you know, protect his turf. And that's a disingenuous argument, because the president has the most powerful tool at his disposal, which is the veto. And every other president has vetoed legislation. This president chooses not to do it that way because he knows that if the veto goes back to Congress, Congress can override that veto. And so the Congress is being frustrated in its constitutional role. We've heard that the office of the vice president and the personnel there are, and the report of the task force, the ABA task force, addresses this. Apparently, now it's customary for the office of the vice president to check every piece of legislation to see whether there's anything in that legislation that might encroach on the powers of the president. This is unprecedented as well.
Tory's calling from Vinton, Iowa. Hi, Tory. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
2 points. One, I'm a retired attorney, and I'm definitely sure that you're comparing apples to apples, no matter what that lady you had on said about anyone on the street.
Okay.
And the second point is, in regards to the apathy of the American people toward this usurpation of power, and I would like to bring out a point that Benjamin Franklin made at the early founding of our country. Those who would give up their liberty for security deserve neither.
Tory, are you so sure that the American people are apathetic, or is it just Congress? I mean, Congress is elected to represent them and to sit there and watch. Maybe that's where the apathy is.
Well, I agree with you. I think both in Congress and in the American people. But then you have to realize that Congress is represented by a, quote, majority of the electorate, who we're talking about being apathetic also.
Yeah, and there you see it, and Benjamin Franklin raises it. Michael Greco, thanks very much, Tory, for your call. Michael Greco, do you see apathy around this, or does it just take a while for everybody to sit up and pay attention?
Well, we have, I think, a need for education. The American people historically are very trusting people. We trust our government leaders to do the right thing. Sometimes that trust is misplaced, because what's happening with these signing statements is that there's an absolute assault on the separation of powers doctrine by their use. And it isn't just this president. Let me make that clear.
Mm-hmm.
The task force was very careful to say that other presidents have issued signing statements, but at no time the number of challenges to provisions of law. This is way off the charts.
But where were you guys then when President Clinton, let's say, was doing this, or President Reagan, or any earlier president? Where was the ABA then?
Those presidents, Tom, were not using the presidential signing statement to indicate that they were not going to enforce the law. Rarely. A couple of them did it. Before 1980, maybe a dozen instances where a president said that through a statement, a signing statement, that he didn't intend to enforce the law. 805 times since 2000 and since 1980, there weren't more than a handful with Reagan and Clinton and Bush 1. So it's been under the radar.
Different scale now. Mm.
What the Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage did on April 30, when he wrote the story mm-hmm. that I read at the breakfast table on Sunday, and I decided that day to appoint this bipartisan task force.
Broke this open nationally.
He brought it to the to the sunlight on it. Mm-hmm. And now we understand the frequency of them, the purpose made of them, and that's what has caused such consternation, not just on the part of the ABA. We have Republicans and conservatives, and we've heard from a couple of them now in these calls, mm-hmm. who have every right to be concerned about what's happening.
You say it's a bipartisan, unanimous bipartisan task force. Who are some of the Republicans who served on this ABA task force?
Well, you're going to hear from Bruce Fine in a moment. Bruce served in the Justice Department in the Bush administration. Bruce also helped to write presidential signing statements for President Ronald Reagan, a very distinguished, respected Republican, conservative. Mickey Edwards, who is a former congressman from Oklahoma. Mickey Edwards served for I don't know how many terms. He is an avowed conservative, but he is eloquent on this subject and participated in the task force's recommendations, which were unanimous. William Sessions, Republican, conservative, former FBI director, former federal district court judge in Texas. We have others on the task force, retired judges who have served on the bench. We have people who've served in both Democratic and Republican administrations. I tried the best I could to create a bipartisan group so that when they spoke unanimously, as they have done, people cannot dismiss them and say, well, this is some group of elitists or something.
Michael Gergel, let me turn to one of them right now, if I may. One of the Republican conservative members of the task force, Bruce Fine, joins us from Washington. Constitutional lawyer, international consultant with Bruce Fine and Associates, deputy attorney general in the Reagan administration, has authored several volumes on the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. Constitution, and international law, adjunct scholar with the American Enterprise Institute, resident scholar at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Bruce Fine, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for those effusions, but not said under oath.
not under oath, but in full light of day, you signed on to this unanimous task force report. It is pretty tough on this Republican president. As a Republican and a conservative yourself, what are you saying? What's the problem?
Well, I think it's a misnomer to suggest it's harsh on the Republican president. It's harsh on a particular practice that flouts the Constitution irrespective of the partisan affiliation of the incumbent of the White House. The presentment clause is understood by the Founding Fathers and George Washington, our very first president, who also presided over the Constitutional Convention, in establishing legislative power intended a particular role for the president, to sign or veto a law in toto. And if the law is vetoed, there's a possibility of a congressional override. And if there's an override of the law, then there's the possibility of a challenge in a court where a president may hand over defense of the law if he doesn't believe in it to Congress, which has happened on a couple of occasions.
We just heard the Department of Justice through Michelle Boardman for 15 or 20 minutes straight up defend this as in defense of the American Constitution.
Well, I think that's a misreading of the Constitution. It is very explicit that the president shall take care that the laws that he signs shall be faithfully executed. That's a provision in Article 2, not there by accident. King James II was overthrown because the Parliament disputed his right to dispense or suspend the enforcement of the laws. And it was that evil that the Founding Fathers responded to in Article 2. When the president signs a bill and says, well, I'm not going to enforce this provision relating to the prohibition on torture, that provision relating to limiting the military in Colombia to non-combat activities, that is the equivalent of a suspending or dispensing authority, saying, well, that's what the law is, but I will not comply with it. There is a way in which the president can honor the Constitution, and that is to veto a bill if he thinks it is unconstitutional in whole or in part.
We're
217 years, when presidents have vetoed bills for constitutional scruples, Congress has overridden that on once and maybe twice two occasions. So this is not a problem of the president confronting the requirement to enforce a law that's unconstitutional if he vetoes the bill.
We're told that you wrote signing statements for President Ronald Reagan. What's the difference?
Well, the difference was the signing statements are of two genres. One relates to interpreting ambiguous terms in a statute that the president has played an integral role in crafting. That was true, for example, of the 1991 Civil Rights Act amendments. And there, the president is not saying, I will not enforce the law. It's saying, I participated in drafting this law. This is a term that's ambiguous, and this is how I interpret that particular provision. It was calculated, as committee reports and congressional statements are calculated, to provide some history of a statute that would inform a court's interpretation of it if it was disputed in litigation.
And now?
But it was not a statement, in contrast to Bush, where he says, yeah, this is the law. I've signed it, but I simply won't enforce it.
The report says this is not aimed at the Bush administration in particular, but the practice has grown. This is a Republican president. It's supposed to be the conservative party. What's up with Republican conservatism, Bruce Fein? This is your camp. What's going on?
I think this is an abandonment of conservative principles, the fundamental conservative view of human nature and power that informed the founding fathers was the need to have checks and ambition counteract ambition. To avoid abuses and overreaching by government. The founding fathers did not believe that angels would occupy either the White House or Congress. And that is a very conservative view of human nature. And in my judgment, the current president is abandoning that conservative philosophy and is returned to a philosophy akin to King's, which was, just trust me, I can do no wrong.
Do we have a crisis here?
I think it is potentially a crisis if there is a refusal to come forward and try to negotiate and compromise with Congress an acceptable way to deal with statutes that the president feels encroach on his powers or otherwise. We don't want to be too hasty in pushing things to an extreme. On the other hand, there has to be some point which you draw a line and say, if this abuse persists, there is only one ultimate remedy, and that is impeachment. But that should be the very last effort after all other avenues have been exhausted.
Bruce Fein, Michael Greco, stand by. Dennis is calling from Nashville. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Yes, my point is talking about Michelle. I came in on the end of her comments.
The Department of Justice Deputy Assistant Attorney General. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. She just from what I heard, she made it sound like, well, every president has done it to the extent that this president has done, and I will disagree with you, Speaker. I would say that this administration is, and he keeps talking about, well, he's not really talking about this president, but you really have to talk about him because of all the signing statements. But I would say that not only what he has done, if you check with Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, which gives his oath, which is to uphold the Constitution, I would also say that the methodology used in his public signing of the laws, and then what happens, he goes into literally the back room and says, well, I'm not going to do this.
Yes, and off it goes.
Yeah, that's what I think is my main concern is what's going on in public and then what happens. I think if you ask 90% of the people on the street what is a signing statement, they would look at you like you just got off the spaceship.
We're trying to open it right up here, Dennis. We appreciate your call from Nashville. Michael Greco, let me ask you about this notion of the unitary executive that seems to inform a lot of the vice president's office's consideration of presidential power. What is that? And do you see it at play in this signing statement and a resistance to provisions of any of these laws?
Well, we know from what we've read in the press the last several years that Vice President Cheney, who goes back to the Watergate era, and when he saw what he perceived to be a weakening of the power of the president in the early 70s, that he is intent on rebuilding and reinforcing the power of the presidency. That's what is referred to as the unitary executive branch, a strong branch. But the problem is that when you take power, when you give more power to the executive, where is it coming from? It's coming from the other two branches, and that's the risk that we have here. And when you have a president, and again, I'll say it, it can be this president or a successor or others to follow them. Mm-hmm. If we don't stop this practice right now, some future president will say, well, you know, we have precedent. We have we had President Bush who did 800 of those. I'm just following precedent. We have to stop this precedent right now. That's why the ABA is speaking up, because if you have an executive who says to the country, there's a law, I have a constitutional obligation to enforce it, but I'm not going to enforce it, that puts the president above the law. It sends the wrong signal to the rest of us that we can violate the law. No one is above the law in America, not even the president of the United States.
Well, that's what we thought. Bruce Fein, let me ask you. Now Justice Scalia has cited signing statements in a dissenting opinion with the Supreme Court. What's going to happen here? Do you see this as becoming American practice? Is this being sort of solidified into the way we do things in this country, or do you see an effective pushback coming?
Well, Justice Scalia just noted that there was a presidential signing statement that was ignored in referring to legislative history in the famous Hamdan versus Rumsfeld case that was recently decided by the Supreme Court. But it was the Hamdan decision itself which totally discredited this unitary executive theory, which has been employed to say that if there is a particular power that in any respect is entrusted to the president, like fighting wars, then no other branch can have any role in regulating or constraining that power. And that was, the president said, entitled him to create military commissions in defiance of a federal statute, the Uniform Code of Military Justice and a Geneva Convention. And the Supreme Court, 5-3, said that isn't true, that the unitary executive does not mean that Congress doesn't have an equal role in regulating how and when we fight wars. Now, with regard to the ability and the inclination of Congress to react to these overreachings and to establish some kind of constraints, I'm guardedly optimistic that that is in train. These signing statements seem to be so blatant and so contrary to the original intent of the founding fathers that at some point, in my judgment, there will be an effort to litigate this issue, and I am working at present with Senator Spector to draft a bill that will probably be introduced this week to enable the impartial, independent third branch of government to decide whether what the president is doing is consistent with the presentment clause, similar to the decision by the Supreme Court in 1998 holding the line item veto unconstitutional.
But you're not entirely confident that your party's Republican majority in Congress is going to stand up on that? I hear some doubt in your voice.
But fortunately, in our country where we have periodic elections, the game doesn't end with one particular Congress. We have elections, party powers can change, philosophy can change, and that's why it's so critical that there continuing to be public debate and argument of the type that's being generated by your program. It isn't necessary that we have a statute in this Congress. As long as we get the philosophy and the understanding of the vice in the public forum where it becomes then prevalent and accepted and understood, at that point it will get enacted into law, whether it's the 107th Congress or otherwise. But the Constitution and our democracy isn't self-executing. Things can change, but only if people debate and argue and are convinced that things ought to change.
Well, we're listening closely today and watching closely. You could hardly have bigger stakes and bigger issues. Bruce Fein, we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bruce Fein, former Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. And Michael Greco, president of the American Bar Association. We've just got a few seconds. What's your level of confidence that this will turn around, Mr. Greco?
I'm very hopeful, because what Mr. Fein just said and what you've said, Tom, is that there's an educational effort that has to happen. We have to educate Americans around the country as to what the stakes are. And when good-hearted Americans understand the issues, they will speak out. I am hopeful that the recommendations made by the ABA task force, the bipartisan task force, will be taken seriously by Congress, and it looks like at least one senator, Spector, is taking them seriously because he's going to, with Bruce Fein's help,
producing legislation. We will be watching. Michael Greco, thanks very much for joining us. This is On Point.